from 90.9 WBUR. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, a possible retrial for a man who spent 32 years in prison for a murder that he maintains he did not commit.
Let's get to this new trial. I wanted a new trial from day one.
Also today, the scathing report from a Philadelphia grand jury about clergy sex abuse and what might come next.
It was pure evil. The criminality of the pedophile priests and the supervisors and allowing the sexual abuse to happen has caused irreparable harm to many, many victims.
Plus, plans for Boston's Northern Avenue Bridge and how the city might make the most out of that historic structure.
This is not simply just building a bridge. This is making a connection. This is connecting all of our city.
And the world of sports with, of course, the Red Hot Red Sox.
He's diving into second base and he's got himself a double.
Calm down.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Massachusetts prosecutors may hold another trial for a man whose murder conviction was overturned after he spent 32 years in prison. Darrell Jones became emotional during his court hearing today about the evidence that might be used in another trial for a murder that Jones maintains he did not commit. WBUR's Bruce Gellerman, who discovered evidence that led to Jones being released from prison, was at today's hearing. Hi there, Bruce.
Hi, Deb.
So what happened today?
Well, it was supposed to be another routine hearing in this case that's gone on, as you say, 33 years, but it turned out to be very dramatic and intense day in court. It started out as a kind of a textbook case. Jones's attorney, who's named Paul Rudolph, presented two motions, one to dismiss the case entirely and another to suppress a key piece of evidence that had been tampered with by a Brockton police officer. It was a 1985 video recording of an alleged eyewitness named Terry Lynn Starks.
The Commonwealth lost, destroyed, or failed to preserve two items of evidence. One, a portion of the recorded interview of a critical eyewitness. And two, the substance of the interrogation of Mr. Jones. We've shown that this evidence is not just material, but critical in this case.
Deb, this is a key piece of evidence. This was used to convict Jones back in 1986, and we now know that it actually was not an original that was shown to the jury, but a copy, and had been at the original trial. Had that been known, it would never have been allowed as evidence. Now, 33 years ago, Terry Lynn Starks was in a car outside of a bar. She was with four other people. It was late on a November night. It was very dark. It was rainy. They were faced in the opposite direction of this murder. And a Brockton detective named Joe Smith interviewed this woman, Terry Lynn Starks, 9 days later. They found her up in Methuen, and they returned to Brockton. This detective told Terry Lynn Starks that Jones had been arrested. She says on the video that she doesn't name Jones. She's shown a photo by Smith, who says the photo is of Jones. Starks only refers to a shorter man and who is the shooter, and a taller man, the victim. But I got to tell you, Jones is 6 feet tall, and the victim was 6'1", so hardly any difference between the two people.
So I guess why use this video as evidence, especially after the first court ruling we got from Superior Court Judge Thomas McGuire, who said that this tape was deliberately doctored, and then Jones was released because of that, right, from prison in December?
Right, and it gets even stranger. There's this bizarre edit in that videotape that lasts anywhere from about 18 seconds to 2.25 minutes. Expert analysis shows definitively that the tape was deliberately edited. And Judge McGuire, who you mentioned, in overturned Jones's conviction last year, said that Detective Smith, the guy who made that tape 33 years ago, had lied under oath in his court appearance back then, and that he lied again in the evidentiary hearing back in last year, 2017. But Plymouth County Prosecutor Jessica Kenny says that Terry Lynn Starks identified a photo of Jones on the tape, and she says it's critical in the case, except for the small portion about the edit, which he's willing to throw out. Here's the prosecutor.
The entire tape should never have even been played in the Commonwealth's view for the jury. And the only portion that would be sought to be introduced by the Commonwealth at a retrial, if Ms. Starks does not make an in-court identification, would be her prior out-of-court identification as substantive evidence.
Hmm. So, Bruce, you spoke with Terry Lynn Starks just yesterday. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What did she say?
Yeah, she... I had spoken to her a couple of times a few months ago, but yesterday I called her up, and she said she didn't remember the case back in 1986, that she didn't know Jones, couldn't identify them, him, and she actually was very angry to be contacted.
Hmm. So why, Bruce, what's the big picture here? Why does the prosecution want to go through another trial with so many problems, potential problems, with testimony and evidence?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, remember, we got seven eyewitnesses, three of which are dead, and out of the remaining four, three of them basically have recanted. During the trial, they couldn't identify Jones in court. Mm. So it's a really good question. Mm.
So Jones, though, for his part, he wants to be retried. Why?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, he's always asked for a retrial. That's what he's been seeking all these years. And three times his attempts to appeal his case have resulted in nothing. Last year, he got an evidentiary hearing, which turns up that this tape had been doctored. So he's been very frustrated. And today in court, Deb, I got to tell you, at the very end, he stood up and he was really, really frustrated.
Let's get to this new trial. I wanted a new trial from day one. I would prefer the new trial because I know the truth. And what I'm saying is that I've been out here in the world and I can't work because of this. I've been out here roaming around out here unable to do anything I need to do to get on with my life.
Yeah, so he's really frustrated, Deb, and he's saying that the prosecution is just delaying and delaying and delaying, and he wants to move on.
All right. WBUR's Bruce Gellerman, whose reporting in this case actually led to Darrell Jones being released from prison last December, 8 months ago, after spending 32 years in prison. Great work, Bruce. Thanks.
Thank you, Deb.
Stay with us. Coming up, local reaction to the Philadelphia grand jury report outlining decades of child sexual abuse in the Catholic Church. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. The clergy abuse scandal in the Catholic Church now appears to be reaching into the higher ranks of the church. A grand jury in Philadelphia spent 2 years reviewing abuse allegations and has issued a scathing report detailing alleged abuse by hundreds of priests and an apparent systemic cover-up by church authorities. This report says church higher-ups have largely escaped public accountability. Some say this is the broadest examination of the clergy sex abuse scandal since the Boston Globe first broke this story about clergy abuse more than 15 years ago. Here's Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro.
As the members of the grand jury wrote in their report, we need you to hear this. There have been other reports about child sex abuse within the Catholic Church, but never on this scale. For many of us, those earlier stories happened someplace else. Now we know the truth. It happened everywhere.
Well, our next guests will talk about that, some of the history of the abuse scandal here in Boston, and how this report from Pennsylvania might affect the church and all abuse survivors going forward. Also, listeners, we'd like to hear from you, and we'd like you to comment about this as well. Does this report from Pennsylvania surprise you? What do you think it means for the Catholic Church or for Boston Cardinal Sean O'Malley, who is chair of the Vatican Commission on Clergy Abuse? Have you been affected by the clergy abuse scandal, and what do you think should be done from here? You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. With me in the studio to talk about this is Terry McNiernan. He's founder and president of the organization bishopaccountability.org. Thanks for coming in.
Pleasure to be here.
So, Terry, what's your overall reaction, first off, to this Philadelphia report? Some 300 priests, about 1,000 abuse survivors, massive numbers.
Massive numbers. And once you get past the numbers and begin to experience them in the report, there's a horrifying quality to it and also a horrifyingly familiar quality to it. We've seen this before. We've been down this road before, and yet it's all painfully new as well.
Mm. Some of these allegations were so graphic, talking about child pornography, whips, priests using whips and beating people, minors. I mean, is this the most graphic description of abuse that we've seen yet, or are we forgetting over the years?
No, I think you're right that the grand jury, I think, was committed to truly showing us. I think there's always a tendency, a human tendency, to moderate the impact and some reluctance sometimes in newspapers and public fora to being this explicit. And yet I think there's value in reminding people that this isn't just quote-unquote abuse. It's not just quote-unquote fondling. That what these children went through is something truly horrible.
You have been keeping records on abusive priests for more than a decade, right? How many states or grand juries or investigations have been done so far? And do you have a number of how many priests have been identified?
So in the United States, we're seeing this is the 11th or the 10th, depending on how you count. And Pennsylvania is unique in the United States in now having been covered by grand juries from border to border. There were a couple in Philadelphia, one in Altoona Johnstown recently, and now this report that covers the other six dioceses. In addition to that, of course, there have been reports, similar reports, in other countries, including really the mother of all these reports, the Royal Commission report that came out at the end of last year, the absolutely finest work that's ever been done on this.
Why is that?
It's because they had subpoena power. They had command to. They had the power to command the attendance even of Cardinal Pell at their hearings. They had the ability to gather documents on the broadest scale, not simply a single state, as we see in this grand jury report, but the entire country of Australia was subject to the Royal Commission. They had eminent commissioners in charge of it. They had a large staff. They had adequate funding. They produced an enormous final report and thousands of pages of documents online. So some people say this is what we need to aspire to in the United States.
Well, remind us of what happened here in Massachusetts. Right? Boston Globe breaks a story about clergy abuse in 2002. We had an investigation here. How does ours compare? Let's start with maybe not the gold standard, but how about Pennsylvania, what we heard about just yesterday? How does what happened here in Massachusetts compare in terms of investigating this? And then I want to ask you, because it just seems like, oh, it's another church crisis. Why does this seem to keep happening? Is it getting deeper? Is it the way we investigate? So first off, Massachusetts versus Pennsylvania. What's going on there?
So the Massachusetts report was done by the Attorney General. The so-called Riley report was...
former AG Tom Riley.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Valuable in its way, and it focused really on the managerial aspects of the crisis, not in Massachusetts as a whole, but in the Boston Archdiocese. And we learned a lot about how the abuse managerial effort was organized in Boston. It was not focused, as the Pennsylvania grand jury report was, on identifying so many priests, 301 in the Pennsylvania report, nor was it so graphic and detailed, as you've said, in its description of the managerial problems. But it did have its value. It did not yield any indictments, Riley said, because the laws simply were not written to allow him to pursue the responsible parties so long after the actual crimes had been committed.
Same thing in Pennsylvania, right?
Exactly.
Statute of limitations.
I mean,
so it's sort of similar. So why is it that we continue to have these lengthy investigations And maybe, is it good? It's an airing, certainly, public airing. And of course, this is still, there's still legal wrangling, we should say, going on over this report of some folks who think their names should not be included in these allegations and they haven't had a chance to defend themselves. And there's all that legal wrangling going on. But at the same time, we're continuing to hear this and these investigations are seem to be going deeper and broader. So why are we not seeing reform or change, do you think?
Yeah. Well, a grand jury properly would indict, and the criminal process would take its course. That's not possible in the case of Pennsylvania, for example, because the crimes, most of them, except for those committed by two priests, Sweeney and Paulson, are out of statute. So the problem fundamentally is that the statutes of limitations are written in such a way that these crimes are out of reach. Because, and the Pennsylvania grand jury goes into some detail in explaining this, there's what they call a circle of secrecy around these crimes. The church has been very good at, in a sense, gaming the statute of limitations, keeping these things secret until they really can't be addressed by the laws as they are currently constituted, which is why in Philadelphia, one of the earlier grand jury reports, there were recommendations that the statute of limitations needed to be changed in Pennsylvania. And Shapiro, of course, in this
the
most
Attorney
recent
General
report,
in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm.
Has made that recommendation again and has made it very pointed by saying in his press conference yesterday that he expects the bishops to get behind this effort. Whether that will happen or not is anyone's guess.
Okay. I want to remind listeners, we'd like you to weigh in this conversation about the latest in the clergy abuse scandal report out of Pennsylvania yesterday, listing about 1,000 clergy abuse survivors, some 300 alleged abusive priests. What do you think should be done from here? Have you been affected by the clergy abuse scandal, which, of course, broke in Boston in 2002? You can join the conversation by calling 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. I want to go to someone who's on the line with us right now who can talk a little bit about this from the victim's perspective, and that is lawyer Mitchell Garabedian. Mr. Garabedian, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Deb.
So your initial reaction to this report from Pennsylvania?
What took them so long? Hmm. I have been representing victims for decades. And for decades, I've been hearing about the criminality of abusive priests and supervisors within the Catholic Church. And as Terry aptly stated, there needs to be issues addressed involving statute of limitations. There needs to be transparency. The common thread we saw in Pennsylvania and in Boston and in so many dioceses is secrecy. When the child is sexually abused by the priest threatens the child, who sees the priest as a representative of God on earth, and the priest says to the child, you better not tell anyone, or you're going to burn in hell, or your parents are going to get divorced, and the child believes that. Then when a parent does report it to the pastor or monsignor or the chancery, the parent is told, you cannot tarnish the image of the church. You cannot take that approach. It will hurt the church and many parishioners, and the parent believes that.
You know, is that still going on, though? I mean, I could see it decades ago, Mitchell, but now it's still happening?
Oh, yes. This is religion. Mm. Oh, yes, without a doubt. I get calls from many Boston victims still coming forward who could not cope in their 60s or their 70s, who are in 80 years old, who come forward and say, listen, I've been dealing with this my whole life, and my mother used to go to church every day, mm-hmm. and we were taught to put the church before our family. They're known as cradle Catholics. Mm-hmm. The secrecy is even written into canon law. Canon law states when clergy sexual abuse matters are looked into, they shall be kept secret.
Now, you released a statement today saying that three of these abuse survivors in Pennsylvania contacted you, and they say the names of their alleged abusers, the alleged abusive priests, are not included in this grand jury report. What do you make of that, and can you tell us, Mitchell, about your role with these survivors in Pennsylvania?
Well, I believe it's what has happened in Pennsylvania with regard to these victims coming, these brave victims coming forward, and the list of priests is only the foundation And the list of priests, abusive priests, is going to grow in Pennsylvania, and the number of victims is going to grow substantially in coming forward. When a clergy sexual abuse victim comes forward, they not only empower themselves, but they empower other victims to come forward. And they're to be commended for making the world a safer place for children. But this is literally the tip of the iceberg. Victims feel, sexual abuse victims, clergy sexual abuse victims feel alone. They feel like they did something wrong. They feel like they're the only victim. They feel like they will not be believed. They have a lack of self-esteem, a lack of self-control, a lack of trust. And when they hear another victim has come forward, they're empowered. And they feel as though, I'm not the only one. Maybe it wasn't my fault. Mm-hmm.
All right, I want to take a call right now because, Mitchell, I think you might be able to help answer this caller's question. Laura is calling from New York. Laura, here on the air.
Hi. I'm wondering if the victims can file a civil suit, and if they can, would that make the Catholic Church go bankrupt?
Okay. Well, Lawyer Garabedian, civil suit, is that a possibility? Because we did talk about the statute of limitations and how they can limit legal action, particularly in the Pennsylvania case.
It depends on what state you're talking about. It depends on which state the abuse happened. For instance, in Pennsylvania right now, the statute of limitations in civilly allows a person to file before age 30, okay, which is not a very, very large window. So, and Attorney Shapiro discussed the extension of statute of limitations yesterday, Attorney General Shapiro, and he was right. The statute of limitations need to be amended. So, you know, what I do when I represent victims in other states, I retain local counsel to work with me, and we review the statute of limitations. We review the issues in terms of whether the statute is allows a victim to sue not only the perpetrator, but the supervisors, because, you know, or the church, because sometimes you find two different sets of rules. So it depends on the unique facts of your case and the state you're going to be filing suit in. Will it lead the church to be bankrupt? Church is the richest institution in the world. I've had so many discovery issues with regard to churches claiming they were broke or didn't have any money, when in fact they were hiding their money in separate corporations like the cemetery fund. So, you know, you're dealing with the richest institution in the world. Ironically, I believe it was recently named that Apple was the first trillion-dollar company named in the stock market, the U.S. stock market. Catholic Church was a trillion-dollar organization decades ago.
Okay, Mitchell Garabedian, an attorney specializing in clergy sex abuse cases. He's represented more than 1,000 survivors of clergy abuse. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
I also want to touch in now with Thomas Groom. He's a professor of theology and religious education at Boston College. Professor, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Deborah.
So what's your reaction to this grand jury report from Pennsylvania?
Oh, goodness. Well, just when we thought that we couldn't be shocked or scandalized or saddened any further, then you pick up today's paper and the headlines, hundreds of priests abusing thousands of children in Pennsylvania alone. I mean, how tragic. Tragic, first of all, of course, for the victims, survivors. But then tragic for the church, because, and for those of us loyal Catholics who hang in with our church, we're so embarrassed by this. We're so disappointed by this, that the institution that should be representing the rich quality of our faith, the rich truths and ethic and values of our faith, the gospel values that Jesus preached and that the church is supposed to represent. All of us fall short, of course, and yet the institutional failure here is just abominable, extraordinary. What will it take for the church to truly address this along the lines that Terry McKiernan and Mitchell Garabedian have been talking? That's where we have to move with this, that this isn't just another, hopefully this is not another report that we add to all the other reports and call for more reports.
Right.
But speaking as a person of the church, when will my church really move to address why did these dreadful crimes happen? Why were they allowed to continue happening? And I think the first question pertains to the culture surrounding Catholic priesthood. I think the second question, why was it allowed to continue happening, pertains to some lack of accountability on the part of our bishops, the lack of lay voices in the structures of the church and the governance of the church. So I think there's just huge problems and challenges that face the church. I hope we can rise to it, because otherwise this beloved faith of ours that so many of us still find so meaningful, so life-giving, is just being betrayed, and to the detriment and to the suffering of such innocent children.
I want to talk for a moment about Cardinal Sean O'Malley, because he has a very prominent role in the Vatican in terms of dealing with clergy abuse. He's the chair of the Vatican Committee. It's got a very long title, but essentially the Vatican Committee to prevent...
Protection of minors.
Thank you. Protection of minors.
Is the actual, I think, the actual title. Thank you.
But I'm just wondering, I want to ask Terry McKiernan this question too. In terms, and I want both of you to weigh in, but let's bring Terry back into the conversation here. Terry, what about the way Cardinal O'Malley, because this is years now that he's been on this commission, the way he's handled this, has it, what can we point to that says that there's been tangible change from this commission and how the church has dealt with this thus far? You're sighing.
I'm sighing a little bit because there hasn't, in fact, been a lot of tangible change out of the commission. In fact, the two survivors on the commission, Mary Collins, an eminent Ireland survivor, and Pete Saunders, felt eventually that they had to leave because they were so frustrated in part by the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, the former Inquisition, and its role and failure really to step up to the plate in all of this. They ultimately felt exasperated and had to walk out. My personal theory about Cardinal O'Malley is that he is genuinely ahead of the curve in the United States, but not quite in the position perhaps that he's lionized as occupying. But he offered, to begin with, perhaps too much of a challenge to the Pope, because the Pope wasn't where he needed to be himself. I think the Pope has only really gotten to the point where he's receptive to this problem because of the crisis that's happening in Chile right now. I think that forced him to attend and to listen in a way that he hadn't before. And I guess my hope is that as a result, O'Malley's stock rises at the Vatican compared perhaps to the Sedanos and other denizens of that peculiar institution, and that as a result, we will see some genuine results out of the Vatican. The commission suggested that there be a tribunal to handle, quote-unquote, bishop accountability. The Pope accepted this recommendation and then walked away from it. He's got to walk back.
Before Professor Groom weighs in on Cardinal O'Malley, we never got to the numbers of abusive priests that bishopaccountability.org has identified thus far. And Mitchell Garabedian says this Pennsylvania report's tip of the iceberg. Do you agree? And what percentage of the priests that you've identified so far do you think might represent the entire problem?
Yeah. So the bishops themselves, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, has tallied the number, not the names, but the number of accused priests that they consider credibly accused over the years. That number is a shade under 7,000 priests in the United States alone, of whom we have been able to identify about 4,400. So there are thousands of priests out there, some of them deceased, but some of them possibly laicized, living in communities, that people are not able to recognize as the sexual offenders that they are. Now, as far as this report goes, take the Diocese of Pittsburgh, important diocese included in this report. Now Cardinal Wuerl, when he was bishop there, reported that there were 51 accused priests. This report appears, and lo and behold, there are 90 accused priests, 48 of whom we have never heard the names of before. So that, I think, speaks pretty eloquently to the tip of the iceberg and what might be lurking under the surface.
I want to take a call, too, before we get right back to you. Professor Kathy is calling from Weston. Kathy, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. There was another way that priests abused kids in this. I was 10 years old. I was being abused by an older brother. I confessed to adultery. And instead of getting help, I got 50 Our Fathers and 50 Hail Marys. And it took me 8 more years to figure out how to get out of that situation. To me, that was clergy abuse.
Not taking your report seriously.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And just giving me a penance that said it was my fault. Mm-hmm. Because I've never before and never since gotten 50 Our Fathers and 50 Hail Marys.
Kathy, I'm so sorry for what you've been through. I appreciate your call. I'm wondering, Professor Groom, do you think when we talk about, you mentioned culturally.
What a tragic story we just heard.
It was a very, very tragic.
But please.
And I feel terrible for Kathy, but I'm wondering if it says something about the culture of the church that you had mentioned earlier and how perhaps the church may or may not be changing. We heard certainly with the controversy at the St. John's Seminary in Brighton, Massachusetts, and Cardinal O'Malley launching that investigation, that part of this was because of online posts from seminarians who say that they're part of the Catholic Me Too movement. Are we seeing a change, or what do you think? How would you describe it? What's happening
well,
right now?
Well, Deborah, if I could go back to your question earlier about and that Terry was talking about as mm-hmm. well, have we made progress? And I think we have to grant that some progress has been made. I mean, the Dallas Charter is somewhat of an achievement by the American Catholic bishops, and indeed, if it would be something similar, it would be implemented throughout the world. The Church Universal would have made progress. Regarding the Cardinal O'Malley, I mean, he's not the Pope, but he's a key advisor to the Pope. And I would put my life on it that one of the chief voices in turning Pope Francis around, as it were, especially regarding the situation in Chile, was Cardinal O'Malley. So that I think he genuinely is committed to the kind of reform and reconstruction and what have you that is desperately needed. Will he be as successful as he could be? Could it be? Could it? Would it? Should have been? Probably not. But he's certainly committed to it, and I think has a lot of integrity in that commitment, and has, I think, some achievements. Even though this commission hasn't had the results that we would wish it could have, but it's a long haul, I suppose. And reports like the one out of Pennsylvania hopefully will help move us forward. But I've no doubt about Cardinal O'Malley's commitment to the reform of the church and the church structures that need to be reformed to solve this problem. So that it doesn't simply continue, and that justice is done, that we have a transitional justice as we move to a new situation or to a better situation, that the people who were victimized and who were abused and so on will get some sense of recompense, justice or something. The Me Too, that would be my fear. I have personal doubts about the advisability of a seminary formation that takes young men and kind of puts them all together in a confined situation in a seminary where they take all their courses and all of their formation and so on in this one kind of hotbed. I think it's a recipe for disasters of the kind that we might be seeing. Most of the religious orders don't have seminaries anymore. They locate their houses of formation near a center of good Catholic theology, like in Washington or in Boston or in Berkeley or someplace. And then they have the form, but they come out for their courses and their classes, and they have classes with lay men and women and married and single and people who are preparing for vocations in lay ecclesial ministry. I think it'd be a far healthier environment for training and preparing the priests of the future. But this business at St. John's, I think there'll be other seminaries that will also be have such accusations or claims made against them. It could be an opportunity for the church to think the whole structure of priestly formation and how we go about it.
Okay, Professor Thomas Groom, he's a professor of theology and religious education at Boston College. He's also author of the book, What Makes Us Catholic. Thanks so much for being with us.
Happy to. Thank you.
Terry McKiernan, founder and president of the organization bishopaccountability.org. Thanks as always, Terry.
Thanks for having me.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. What is going on with that large rusting relic in Fort Point Channel in the seaport? Coast Guard says get rid of it. Some say preserve it. It represents old industrial Boston. We're talking about the Northern Avenue Bridge. It was shut down to cars more than a decade ago, closed off to pedestrians in 2014, and now city officials have a multi-million dollar plan to redevelop the bridge. But this is raising some questions. Should it be pedestrian only? Or should cars be allowed? And should it be another gateway to the seaport for vehicles? Well, joining us to talk about this is Dan McNichol, an author and infrastructure consultant. Hi there, Dan. Welcome.
Thanks, Deb.
So why focus on redeveloping this bridge right now?
Well, that's a loaded question, but it's a beautiful structure. It fits a spot in Boston that's missing as far as restoration, as preservation. It's a part of the modern age. And it's definitely a critical connection that's missing between the seaport, the booming seaport, and downtown Boston.
So it's my understanding that the options, very simply, of course, are get rid of the thing and build something completely new or rehab. What's your view?
Should we get rid of Fenway? Should we have gotten rid of it back in 1997? Of course not. And I think to lose this would be to lose a national treasure as well as a local icon.
Why is it a treasure? What does it represent?
Well, it represents the machine age, but it also represents a part of nautical history of Boston. It represents a connectivity. It represents a style of bridge that was very simple when it was built that's almost disappearing from the Boston scape. The Charlestown Bridge is going to be torn down. Broadway Bridge, the Old Colony Bridge, all these bridges were similar old steel bridges that are gone. And this somehow has survived all the politics and all the time.
Hmm. So that in and of itself makes it a relic. Well, let's talk about what city officials have said so far. Boston Mayor Marty Walsh spoke about the bridge in 2016. We have a little clip of what he said. Let's listen.
This is not simply just building a bridge. This is making a connection. This is connecting all of our city. It's something that people, when they come to our city, should want to have to see what the Northern Avenue Bridge will look like.
So Dan McNichol, the mayor says this is an important structure in the city, in the seaport. There's a task force looking into what to do with the Northern Avenue Bridge. And part of the issue here is General Electric, which moved to the seaport. And part of the deal with General Electric was that this bridge would be repaired and wouldn't be this hulking, rusting relic sitting there in the water. So the mayor initially said he would support a bridge that took cars and pedestrians. Is that right?
Well, I'm not sure about the cars, but I know General Electric is saying, absolutely. I saw the paragraph and the letter of intent saying, we are excited about coming to Boston, but you must fix this. And they were excited about all the pedestrian activity, all the millennials that were biking and moving about the city, going to the seaport. And that's one of the reasons they picked Boston, one of the reasons they picked the seaport.
Mm-hmm. But they are also thinking it's going to help ease traffic congestion because now it's very difficult to get to the seaport. So your thoughts, cars or no cars?
I say no cars, but if it means saving the bridge, then bring the cars on. But the cars would be better suited on the Evelyn Moakley Bridge with a zipper lane, kind of like the Southeast Expressway, to store cars during rush hour trying to get into the 93 northbound tunnel is really the problem. It's a late afternoon rush hour problem. This, I think, would help the congestion with cars included by getting buses and bikes and pedestrians out of the way and onto a new route.
Do you think that rehabbing this bridge will help deal with the traffic in the seaport?
It definitely will. The growing numbers of bikers, the growing numbers of pedestrians, the people moving about, tourists, commuters, residents, is undeniable. And this will offload some of that. But as far as traffic, I think the buses are probably the biggest contributor would be to get these buses that go through the Seaport District on their way over to North Station or anywhere downtown, give them a boost, get them to the front of the line, get them off the Seaport and into downtown by allowing them privileged access.
So maybe a bus bridge to take these buses.
Portland, Oregon did this. They have a trolley, bus, pedestrian, bicycle bridge. They spent $136 million or north of that on that bridge. I think this is that magnificent of a bridge that it deserves a part of that kind of investment.
Explain to me a little bit more about what your ideal vision of what the Northern Avenue Bridge would be under Dan McNichol's plan.
Well, thank you. it's so beautiful to walk through it, to experience something remarkable, and that's what gets people excited. The bridge restored. It's a very simple flat iron bridge at grade level. Restore it, bring it back, and let it swing. It's like a 800-pound elephant doing a pirouette when it opens and swings and shuts. It's part of the movement, part of the magic. Bring back they call it the steam house, or they call it the bridge tender's house. It sits there on the bridge today, half form. The other half was torn down already. And then bring back this fireboat house that was sitting over by the courthouse on the fixed end of the bridge. It was a five-story structure, beautiful terracotta ceiling, shingles, and it allowed for the fireboat house to have a presence right on the harbor. That could be converted into a wooden boat center like Seattle also has, a center for wooden boats, to get people into the harbor, into the ocean. Mm. I spent a lot of time there, and it's very difficult to get in the water, not to walk along the harbor walk, but to get in the water. And I think getting people in boats on the Four Point Channel, activating the water sheet, would make that bridge absolutely complete. Hmm. Make it a boathouse.
Well, let's talk about money, because it's always money, right?
Sure,
cost
sure.
Significant here. $15 million just to take down the bridge was the last estimate I saw, anywhere between $30 and $70 million. The city has about $46 million in city funds, I think, and Congressman Lynch, who represents this area, says he's got about $9.4 million in federal funding. And he is also, by the way, supporting car lanes on the bridge. But the costs are significant. And we did speak with Rick Domino, who's president of the nonprofit A Better City. And he's also chair of Mayor Marty Walsh's task force about the Northern Avenue Bridge. And this is what he says about money.
If we want a bridge that has historical context and relevance and respect for preservation, that's a very important goal, but it costs money to do that.
It does cost money. So, Dan McNichol, where would the money come from?
Well, there's two opportunities that I mentioned earlier. The bridge tender's house, that could be converted at its full size into a lot of square feet. That's very, very valuable. The fireboat house brought back, somewhat like the Tea Party Museum on the Congress Street Bridge, but this would be actually historic and accurate. Bring back that fireboat house, make that a usable private-public partnership in some way. Mm-hmm. But really, the money, for example, there's $100 million set aside for the bridge out to Long Island, which to me looks like a dead end. I'm a city taxpayer, so I can appreciate the struggles here, but why $100 million to an island when we want to preserve the harbor islands, maybe bring them back to their natural beauty, get rid of the highway bridge? Why not service that with boats? Why not put the $100 million already dedicated to that project back into the city to create access to the water for Mattapan students, children, parents? Dorchester's blocked off by the water from 93, Roxbury, East Boston, Charlestown. The list goes on. This could be the spot where people get into the ocean, get into the harbor, and celebrate the past, celebrate the connectivity that this bridge represents. It's much more about than connecting physically. It's also about connecting to the past, and I think that's critical. And if we get rid of it, we'll never be able to reproduce anything like it.
Now, I just want to ask you, because this is something that might immediately come up in folks' minds when they're listening to this conversation. Does redoing this bridge only really serve a fraction of the city? How could it be that the bridge might serve people beyond the Seaport? Why should people outside of the area care about the Northern Avenue Bridge?
Well, I think when people come to Boston, they love to see the old. They love to see Paul Revere's home. They love to see the texture of Boston, which is complex. And this is that missing patch in the quilt. This is a part of Boston's history that's being torn down as we speak. The Charlestown Bridge is about to go. The Broadway Bridge is gone, long gone. This is a part of experiencing something moving, something historic. And it's to walk through it, to bike through it, to drive through it. I've done all of those things over the years. It makes you remember Boston as much as any experience you could have in Boston.
Okay. Dan McNichol, author and infrastructure consultant, thanks very much for coming in today.
Well, thank you, Deb. Thanks for having me on.
We want to turn now to sports, as we do most Wednesdays. Here with us to do just that is Radio Boston's own Chris Sidorick. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Deb.
So it's August. We're in Boston, and we've got to start with the Red Sox, of course. They topped the Phillies last night, 2-1. So what can you tell us about this win?
Well, it was definitely another exciting win for a team that's had a lot of those this year. It's their fifth win in a row. They won 7 out of 8 so far on the road trip they're on. Their record's now 86-35. It's an unprecedented record. They're 10 games up on the Yankees. It's been a heck of a season for these guys. Really encouraging last night. Rick Porcello, the starting pitcher, had a great game. Gave him 7 innings, 10 strikeouts. Only gave up 2 hits, didn't walk anybody, so control wasn't an issue. That's great to see because he had a rough start in Toronto. Last go out, gave up 7 runs over 4 innings. The team also got a home run from the catcher, Sandy Leon. Great to see, obviously, but it's actually his work behind the plate that was getting some attention last night. Rick Porcello actually spoke to reporters after the game and talked about what it's like to have Leon calling the game.
No disrespect to any other catcher that I've thrown to, but he's the best catcher I've ever thrown to. His game calling, he's prepared for every start, for every pitcher starting or bullpen. He's kind of the heartbeat of our pitching staff.
So it's not uncommon for pitchers to have favorite catchers to throw to. Hardcore fans will remember the infamous Doug Mirabelli police escort to get to a Tim Wakefield game. But it's high praise to hear Porcello saying that starter, reliever, whoever you are, you love throwing to Sandy.
I heard that Porcello got to swing the bat.
Yeah. Last night's the interleague game. Obviously, they're in Philadelphia playing the Phillies. So National League team, National League stadium, National League rules. I love watching baseball this way. I don't know about you, but there's nothing better than seeing a highly paid athlete do something they're uncomfortable doing. And a lot of pitchers can't stand coming to the plate. But it actually led to a great moment last night. Porcello ripped a line drive in the third, and he ended up sliding head first in the second.
Line shot right field. Williams on the move. He's not going to get it. Porcello strikes again. Up against the wall. He's diving into second base, and he's got himself a double.
Calm down.
So isn't that a little risky for a pitcher?
Yeah, I mean, you can hear it right in the play-by-play. Calm down. You don't want to see your pitchers diving head first. Bogaerts actually jammed his finger on a head first slide a couple of days ago. Not a serious injury, but just kind of goes to show you the head first slide can be a questionable move. Some Sox fans might harken back to Stephen Wright in 2016 when John Farrell, the manager at the time, actually pinch ran Stephen Wright, which is a weird move. He ended up hurting his shoulder, was out for a while. So high stakes, and even after seeing it on the video, Porcello himself said it was pretty rough.
I don't know how everyone sees the ball coming in and everything like that so well. I was running, and I couldn't see anything. It was blurry, and I figured the throw was coming in, so I better slide. I saw the replay of it. It didn't look very good. It was more of a crawl into second. So
so lucky.
Great moment.
Yeah. So what's next for the Red Sox? What should we be watching for?
So I said they were 7-8 on this road trip. Mm. They've got one more game against the Phillies tonight, and then they've got a 7-game homestand coming up against Tampa Bay, and then the Indians this weekend and then into next week. And I highly encourage folks, if you haven't seen this team play, this is an exciting bunch of guys. Get down to Fenway for this homestand.
Worried about this curse of doing well in August, right?
I like wins. I don't understand people who say they're winning too much. Doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Okay, well, let's go to another topic. We have just a little bit of time left. U.S. Gymnastics Championships come to Boston starting tomorrow.
Yes, starting tomorrow night, running through Sunday. It's the first time that the championships are in Boston since 2008. It's going to be both the men and the women, juniors and seniors, and obviously they're competing for spots on the U.S. team for the World Championships coming up in October, and with hopes making the Olympics team in 2020.
Okay, this is a really tough time for gymnastics. We probably all remember, especially gymnast Allie Raisman, who's a local girl, and then the testimony in the trial of Larry Nassar, who was the U.S. team doctor accused of abusing hundreds of young female gymnasts. He's now in prison. But I wonder how has this affected the sport and participation?
Yeah, I mean, gut-wrenching testimony. You saw over 150 gymnasts make a victim impact statement last January. So It has led to some changes. The U.S. Olympics Committee basically threatened to decertify USA Gymnastics. There's been some squabbling back and forth about whether USA Gymnastics kind of the buck stops here or if it's the U.S. Olympics Committee. The president of USA Gymnastics, Steve Penny, at the time he's stepped down due to public pressure. The entire board ended up resigning basically after an ultimatum from the U.S. Olympics Committee. And they've instituted some different changes to try to affect change in the culture. So they've mandated safe sport training, for example. And interesting that you mentioned Allie Raisman. She is actually speaking out right now saying she is invited to this by the TD Garden, not by USA Gymnastics. USA Gymnastics has had some things to say about that as well. We'll post that to the website.
All right. Radio Boston's Chris Sitter. Chris, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.